welcome to episode 44 of Did You Bring the Hummus podcast. I'm Kimberly, your host, and I'm super excited to be here with you today. Did You Bring the Hummus is a podcast to help you go vegan. This season, I'm sharing new episodes every Monday discussing all things vegan. Most importantly, we'll talk about how to embrace this meaningful decision with fervor and fun. Episodes post every Monday on your favorite podcast app. Before we get started, I have one very important question for you. Did you bring the hummus? Did you know that I offer one-on-one coaching? If you've found inspiration in these episodes but want more accountability or help guiding you through exploring a vegan lifestyle, check out my website for more information. In the last few episodes, I've given you quick challenges to bring more vegan items and vegan thinking into your life. How's that going? This week, I challenge you to find a fruit or vegetable at the market or grocery store that you've never tried before and give it a go. Then, of course, let me know how it went. Today, I am joined by Meg Kelly of Learn Veganic. Meg teaches the Learn Veganic online gardening courses to empower people to grow their own fruits and veggies the vegan way, using entirely plant-based fertilizers. Meg has been gardening veganically for 15 years in backyards, on balconies, and in the countryside, and she helps people grow their own thriving gardens that are animal-friendly and sustainable. Meg has been actively promoting veganic gardening and farming since 2008, when she co-founded the Veganic Agriculture Network. She launched the Learn Veganic Gardening course in 2021 to provide aspiring and experienced gardeners with veganic classes, mentorship, and an online community so they can reach their gardening goals. As you'll hear, I had a great time, and I was really into all I was learning during this interview. I hope you come away with the same enthusiasm for connecting with the world around you through growing some plants. Whether on a balcony or a sprawling garden, Meg has some insightful and practical tips to get you started. Hey, Meg, thanks for joining me today.
Hi there, Kimberly.
I am so excited to have this conversation with you. I want so badly to be a gardener, and I am not there yet. But I feel like by the time we are done speaking, I will have a bit more confidence and be ready to maybe give it another go this season. We'll see.
Awesome. That's what I'm looking forward to. Sharing gardening with you so you can get that inspiration going and so that some of your listeners can get inspired to start gardening too.
Yeah, I hope so. All right. So let's get to it. We always start with a question about going vegan. So tell us about your vegan journey.
Yeah, for sure. I can say even as a kid and as a teenager, I was questioning the idea of eating animals. And, you know, when I was about 11, I stopped eating cows and pigs. And it just took me a few more years to make that extra leap to, you know, not eating any animals and to becoming vegan. And I'd say it was really between my first year and second year of university that I just felt ready to do some of that research and felt ready to confront it more. And I really thought it was going to be more difficult going vegan than it was. I think I had it really built up in my mind that this was something that was going to be a huge deal, an enormous transition. And once things were switched out in the cupboards, it really wasn't nearly as difficult as I had made it out to be.
How about that? I too had some moments when I was a kid. I remember asking my mom, who's vegan now, but she wasn't then. I remember asking her about the animals that we were eating. And she was like, it's okay. This is what they're raised for. And when you're like super little and your parents are the authority and they have all the answers, even if it doesn't like sit well with you, you're like, okay. And you move on. Maybe not all kids, but that was my thing. And then there were more seeds planted and more seeds planted. And I stopped buying things that were tested on animals. And it like went from there. And then finally, you know, I got a magazine from, I got an issue of PETA's Animal Times in the mail. And I have no idea why it came to me, but it was addressed to me. And I read it. Yeah, I read it and I was vegetarian overnight, even though I had no idea how to cook. I had no idea what I was going to eat. I didn't like vegetables at all at the time.
That was my issue. I really feel like if I grew up today, I would have become vegan a few years earlier. Because when I was like 15 or 16, I tried to become vegan once or twice, And it lasted about 3 days because I didn't like any vegetables. And I just like pasta with, you know, like cheese on it. And suddenly I was just eating pasta with nothing on it. And so it was more like once I had learned to like veggies and learned to like lentils and stuff, that was the point at which it was more realistic to make that transition.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. We all have like these little moments, right? And it's so awesome that each of us gets there, and we all have like a different story that someone else who's listening can maybe relate to. And that's my favorite thing. So, my goodness, where do we even start? Let's start with defining. So your focus is veganic gardening, and a lot of people, I think, probably have never heard that word before. So can you tell us what that is?
So basically, veganic gardening combines organic gardening and veganism because organic gardening has a lot of things going for it. You know, when we garden organically, we're not using pesticides, we're not using chemical fertilizers, we're taking care of the soil and all of those good things. But a lot of organic fertilizers are animal based, and a lot of them are quite simply byproducts from the industrial farming systems that many of us have already decided we don't want to support. And so, very common organic fertilizers include things like chicken manure from factory farms. It could be, even if you see something called compost, that could be composted shrimp waste and crab waste from the fishing industry. Blood meal and bone meal are very common. And, you know, if you go into a garden center, that's what you'll see for sale. If you ask people for advice about, you know, how do you get bigger tomatoes, they might say to add blood meal and bone meal and things like that. And so obviously, you know, if we've already made that choice that we want to eat fruits and veggies instead of eating animal products because we want to get away from that factory farming system or from agriculture, animal agriculture in general, it's very surprising to find out that our fruits and veggies are still very much connected to those systems. I think the one thing I like about gardening is how we're empowered to make our own choices about how we grow in our own backyards, because we can't really control how a farm is growing. You know, obviously we can try to speak with farmers, you know, we can try to put together little buying clubs in our community to support a veganic farmer. There's obviously things that we can do to try to influence the way our food is grown on farms. But in our garden, we can really make our own choice. Much like we can make the choice to have a vegan kitchen, you know, we can make the choice to have a vegan garden. And so I think that just from that point of view of, you know, the empowerment to actually grow food in a way that's aligned with our values, that's what's really drawn me into veganic gardening. And there are so many ways that we can, you know, switch out those animal products for, you know, plant-based fertilizers. And it's very, very similar to kind of switching out what's in our kitchen cupboards when we go vegan.
I love that. I've got to tell you, I was shocked. Could not believe, because when my husband and I bought our house, one of the things we were super excited about was the fact that there's a section we live like in the mountains. There's giant trees everywhere, which is amazing. There's not a whole lot
Lovely.
of sunlight except in this one patch in our backyard. And we were like, we can grow our own vegetables, as we'd been living in an apartment without like even a balcony. We had no like outdoor space. So this was like big. And we were so excited, and we bought like the little wooden thing to like map out the section, and we had all of our seeds, and we got to buy the soil, and we're looking at the bags. And everything right there on the front, it says like blood meal or bone meal. And I was like, what? Totally like threw off everything. And it's like, okay, what do we do? Because I didn't know about veganic gardening. I had no idea. So it's like, okay, let's just find some like regular not plant soil. And that the ingredients were just, it just said like dirt. It
Even
wasn't,
then, you still don't quite know. I mean,
don't
I've done that
know.
in the past where I buy things and I'm like, well, it doesn't show an animal ingredient, so Right. You know, maybe it's veganic, but you know, you can't even really tell until you until you start emailing places or phoning them. But yeah, that's what I sometimes do recommend to people, is buy the one that looks to be the most vegan if you're in a garden center and you don't know, you know, what options are available.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad to know that there's something, because we did the one garden and the next year nothing grew, so we just kind of gave up, and we're like, we're very lucky that we live near an incredible organic farm, which now when we get there, when they open this year, I'm going to ask them how veganic is their process, because their focus is like the nutrients in the soil and bringing back truly well-grown vegetables that aren't covered in tons of stuff. But, and the doctor himself is vegan. The doctor who owns the farm is vegan. I don't know if the farmer is vegan. I know some of their farm hands are, and some of them aren't, but I'm going to have a conversation with them. I'm very excited to get in touch with someone and find out. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. Let's see, where do we go from here? I would love to, you know what? Why don't we talk about some tips for beginners? Because I'm going on about this garden I tried to grow, and like maybe other people are like, all right, get to it. Tell us about how to grow a garden. So let's talk about how to grow a garden.
So, I mean, when we talk about growing a garden, you know, there's so many aspects we can talk about. We can talk about which plants to choose or choosing a sunny spot, but there's also the whole, you know, fertilization side of it. And the fertilization side, that's where things get a bit trickier from a vegan perspective, because so many things aren't vegan. I could just start with some of the basics for some things that we would always do when we're starting a garden. And, you know, one is, you know, as you said, just to find that sunnier spot, especially if you're in an area where there isn't enough sun. There might be some exceptions to that. If somebody lives in Arizona, they might be looking for the slightly shadier spot. And if there's too much sun exposure, or if it's, you know, if the sun's beating down a bit too hard. But for most of us, we're going to want to look for a sunnier spot, especially if we're growing plants that are fruit bearing. So sometimes we hear that question, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? And botanically it's a fruit, but botanically eggplants are fruit too. And so are cucumbers, so are peppers and pumpkins and squash. And so basically if there's kind of a big fleshy thing that pops out of a flower, botanically that's a fruit, and those are the plants that need the most sun. So if we have a sunnier spot in our garden, we'd like to give it to those fruit bearing plants, just because they have a longer growing season, and it just takes a lot of energy, a lot of sunlight, a lot of time in order to make that, you know, eggplant or tomato for us. And if we have areas that are a little bit shadier, that aren't getting as much sun as we might like, we can put in things like kale and collards and lettuce, spinach, you know, leafy greens in general, and root vegetables will also do a bit better than some other plants with a little bit more shade. One of my favorite plants to grow, I can say, is kale. And one of the reasons I love to grow kale is not only because it's so nutritious, but it's actually a biennial plant, which means that it lives for 2 years. So the cool thing about it is, like, lettuce plants, sort of in the middle of the season, you'll sometimes kind of lose your lettuce plant because it'll decide it's going to go to seed. And when it decides it's going to go to seed, the lettuce isn't really good to eat anymore. Whereas a kale plant, you can just keep eating it for the whole season. And even like the beginning of the second season, it'll live through the winter. So I'm a big fan of choosing some of these low maintenance plants. I love strawberries too. Like the big problem with strawberries is that they spread. So, you know, they'll spread over your whole garden. Whereas for me, I think that's the best problem in the world, to be overrun by strawberry plants. Yeah. And so I really like things like strawberries that are perennials, and they just come back year after year. Some other nice perennials are things like chives or green onions, and things like blueberry bushes and gooseberry bushes. When you plant them once, you've got them for the next, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years. Wow. Which, I mean, I have a garden that I don't even need to plant each year, because I planted it, you know, 1 year with a lot of perennial plants, and they just keep popping up. Things like rhubarb, that'll live for decades. That's the thing I love to do personally, is put in some of these plants that are low maintenance, because a tomato plant or an eggplant, it's higher maintenance. You know, you have to start with a seedling every year. You have to give it a lot of love. Mm-hmm. Whereas like a blueberry bush, you know, once it's set up, you know, as long as you give it a little bit of fertilizer each year and, you know, water it if there's a big drought, but, you know, otherwise you don't need to water it. It'll just keep giving you food year after year. So I really love low maintenance gardens.
All right. Well, I know what bush I'm buying next.
But in terms of like the fertility side of things, that's where things get, you know, that's where we really have to try to veganize it. You know, everything regarding sunlight and which plants we choose, that's kind of the same, you know, for all gardeners. But for kind of, you know, veganizing things, the place I really tell people to start off with is, you know, starting a compost bin, because that's really the way that we can create our own fertilizer at home with something that we might have been sending to the landfill. Right. And thing is, like, all of those veggie scraps that we have are full of precious nutrients. You know, there's lots of, you know, there's phosphorus, there's potassium, there's nitrogen, there's all of these things that our plants need, because the needs of plants are pretty similar. So if you feed plants with plants, mm-hmm. generally they're getting, you know, the nutrients they need and about the right ratios. And when we send those nutrients to the landfill, like if you just put your veggie scraps in the garbage, those nutrients are lost forever. Like they're just mixed a bunch, you know, amongst plastic and tires and everything mm-hmm. else. They're lost. And when they go to the landfill, because there's no oxygen available when they get buried, they actually create methane. And so mm-hmm. there's this huge greenhouse gas impact of sending our food scraps to the landfill. Whereas if we compost them in our own backyards, basically, you know, we end up really lessening our greenhouse gas impact, and we end up creating this nutrient rich fertilizer that's really great at feeding our plants and building up our soil. It can be really simple. If you have some autumn leaves, if you take two parts autumn leaves and one part food scraps and mix them together, you're good. The main way that people fail at composting is that they don't add any leaves. And okay. So if you take a bunch of food scraps and you put them in a pile, that's just a rotting pile of food waste. Mm-hmm. And you really need something like leaves to counterbalance it so that it'll turn into compost that'll basically end up looking like dirt. So basically, you know, every time you put in a bucket of food scraps, you put in two buckets of leaves, or a handful of food scraps, you put in two handfuls of leaves, and just mix them together and keep it kind of ideally protected from the rain so it doesn't get too wet. Mm-hmm. And you know, mix it with a pitchfork, you know, once every week or two. And after a few months, it just breaks down. I mean, this is a very natural process. We don't have to do a lot. We just need to make sure we get some leaves in there and we mix it up a bit. And it's a really, really wonderful way of taking nutrients that we already have that we're going into the waste stream. And the same thing with the leaves. Oftentimes people throw out leaves, or our neighbors might be throwing out leaves, but they're an amazing source of nutrients, because the trees actually go down really, really deep with their root systems, and they can access all sorts of nutrients that like a tomato or a lettuce plant could never access because, you know, their root systems aren't as deep. So the tree is actually full of all sorts of minerals in the leaves. And, you know, when we take those leaves and we compost with them, we're basically, you know, the way I describe it is that we're ethically mining minerals right from our neighborhoods. Whereas if you go to a garden center and you buy potassium or phosphorus that's kind of in a, you know, in a container, that's, you know, the result of pretty large scale mining operations that are really not environmentally friendly. Whereas we've got all of these wonderful nutrients in our neighborhoods right under our feet, and the trees are already doing this amazing job of going down and searching for it and putting in their leaves. And out in like a forest environment, that would decompose and it would nourish the soil. But in a city environment, we tend to treat that as a waste product and we just like send it outside of the city. Whereas if we, you know, keep it right where it is, we can turn it into these amazing fertilizers.
Yeah. I'm thinking, so like I mentioned, I live up in the mountains. There's lots of tall trees and yeah. we have leaves everywhere. There's leaves in our ivy. And when we have the landscapers do the cleanup, they don't take the leaves away. We okay. have a section in our backyard where it kind of like dips down and they blow all the leaves back there. So I
am that's wonderful.
Full of leaves. However, what would you say, or what would you recommend for those of us who live in an environment where we have bears? And so if we have a pile of food, you know, or decomposing with the leaves out there, because the bears are going in the garbage, they're not going to stop a free for all, like, you know, in a pile of food out there, they're going to go nuts on the compost pile. Is there a way to do it without having it just exposed to like the world?
Yeah. So two things pop to mind. One is, you know, it sounds like you personally already have a giant pile of leaves that's sitting in a ditch.
Yeah.
And that's actually perfect because there's actually another technique that's similar to composting, but a little bit different. That's called leaf mold. And leaf mold essentially involves taking a giant pile of leaves and letting it sit for about 2 years. And after about 2 years, it just breaks down into something that looks like dirt. So it takes a bit longer than regular composting because it doesn't have the food scraps in there to kind of speed it up with more nitrogen. So it's a slower process to break down. But it makes this really wonderful material that's incredible for your soil. And most people aren't in a situation like you where they can just have a huge pile of leaves just sitting there. But it is one of the best ways to make a vegan fertilizer is just have a gigantic pile of leaves, let it break down. So you're already in a perfect scenario. And if you start just digging around in there, if you find anything that looks like soil, then just add it to your garden.
Ah, very cool.
Yeah. And then in terms of your food scraps, I understand that the question with the bear issue. So one thing could be to have a very solid compost bin. If you make it out of cedar or larch and, you know, nice thick pieces of wood and you put a padlock on it, I don't think they're necessarily going to get into it if, you know, as you say, if they're already getting into the garbage, I think they're going to find someone else's garbage bin easier than your compost bin. And there's actually another technique called bokashi. And bokashi is an alternative to composting. It's not actually composting, but basically with bokashi, we take some bran that has some microorganisms on it. So it's kind of bran that's been inoculated. And then inside in our house, we can basically have a hermetic bucket that doesn't let oxygen in. And we put our food scraps in there and we sprinkle this kind of bran on it that has microorganisms. And it basically pickles your food scraps.
Oh.
And so basically you end up with this kind of pickled juice that comes off of it that you can fertilize your plants with. But then you end up basically with pickled food scraps that you could then bury in your garden. And so what I've heard is that kind of rodents and bears are not as attracted to these pickled food scraps. And the pickled food scraps can actually decompose in your garden in 2 or 3 weeks. So they actually decompose quite quickly once they're buried there. And they can stay in your house for months because they're not really rotting or putrefying. It's kind of like making sauerkraut in a sense out of all of your food scraps. And the only thing I would say is that not all bokashi starter is vegan because it's kind of bran that's been inoculated with microorganisms. Sometimes those microorganisms come from a vegan source. Sometimes they might come from dairy. So if anyone's thinking of purchasing bokashi, they can just look, you know, if you kind of Google vegan bokashi, you'll find some brands that sell vegan versions, or you can even make a vegan version at home too.
Okay. Oh, that's so cool. I cannot wait to like get out there and start rooting around in the leaves and see what, because we've been doing that since we've lived here. So yeah, the leaves on top are just from this past fall, but underneath we've got 7 years of leaves.
Oh, if you have 7 years of leaves, you can probably, if you're making like a raised bed garden, you can probably just make it out of that. Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning too, having the landscapers come by, if they're ever trimming trees or bushes and there's little branches, little branches are also an amazing source of nutrients. If you add freshly cut branches to your garden, it can be a little problematic because they're really, really high in carbon. And if you add something really high in carbon to your garden, there can be a temporary lack of nitrogen for your veggies, because basically, when you add something like like fresh leaves, or, you know, or sorry, freshly fallen leaves, or wood chips to your garden or something like that. Basically, there's a whole lot of microorganisms that kind of have a population explosion to eat that. And then part of the nitrogen from your soil ends up in those microorganisms. So it's not available to your plants for a while. Okay. So if you take something like freshly chopped, you know, branches, and you put it straight in your garden and you're planting a tomato at the same time, your tomato's not going to be happy. It's going to turn a bit yellow because there's not quite enough nitrogen for it. Okay. But if you take those little branches and you put them in a pile and you let them sit for a couple of years until they decompose, it is an incredible material. And basically it ends up imitating how forest soils are made out in nature. And so it just creates an incredible quality of soil. So if you've got like branches and brush and things like that, and a dish to put them in, I know most people don't have that available, but right. that's just an absolutely incredible way to build a high quality soil. You can just leave those materials in a corner till they break down and then add them to your garden.
Huh, so cool. All right. So let's see. We have some tips on finding the soil and some tips on the best plants. What else? Is there anything else that a beginner gardener would need to know to kind of kick off their veganic journey?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we have a guide that you can get on our website. And so our website is learnveganic.com. And at learnveganic.com/materials, we have a guide to 20 veganic materials for your plant-based garden. And it's kind of like, you know, when we think about like vegan sources of iron or something, or vegan sources of calcium, sometimes we need to be reminded that there's actually a whole lot of them, because sometimes we might only have two or three that pop to mind. And so that was the idea behind this guide, is we want to show people that there's not just compost, or there's not just, you know, the two or three things I've mentioned here. There are so many ways that we can fertilize a garden in a vegan way. And that's, it's a free guide. And when people download it, we also send a list of some companies that sell vegan products for gardens. Because as much as I am a fan of do-it-yourself, and, you know, the things I've suggested to you are very much do-it-yourself and creating your own soil, I also recognize that you have a lot of leaves and a ditch and a lot of time to work with here. And as somebody who's starting a garden on their balcony, or just starting their very first garden, they really might need to buy a bag of something, and that's okay. And, you know, the options in regular garden centers, they're very few and far between. You might not know if something's vegan or not. So we've kind of compiled that list for people that they get sent when they get our guide, which, you know, shows some of those commercial options that can just make it easy for somebody who's starting out, even though ultimately I'd really like people to move toward like the most sustainable practices and making everything on their own and all that. You know, sometimes we just need to know, what's this bag that I can buy that I can order through the mail and just get started next week?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let's get started. And then start, like, as you're eating the vegetables you've grown, put those scraps into your compost pile,
for
right?
For sure.
Yeah. Cause composting,
like, I encourage people to start composting right away, because you have to start composting today to have it ready in a few months, you know, so it is important to get started. But I also know it's not really going to help you with gardening next week. You know, it is going to take a little while for it to be ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we are coming into like planting season, or maybe planting season's already started. You're the expert, not me.
That's where you live. Everybody's planting season is at a different date.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, so where, I believe you're like East Coast area. You're in Canada though, right?
I'm East Coast Canada. I am in a very cold area because I'm kind of like you in the forest. I'm up in the mountains a little bit. So I have about a meter of snow outside.
Oh, wow.
And it's only in the last day or two that we've seen signs that it might be melting.
Exciting stuff. Yeah. So I know for here, for me, that most of the things that I would, you know, the seeds I might buy at the store, they typically say like anywhere from April to May to like start planting outside. But yeah, of course. For anyone listening, not on the East Coast of the United States or Canada, your planting season will be different. So definitely check for that.
Yeah, I'd say one of the main things to be aware of is when is your typical last frost date for the region that you live in. And sometimes even when we look at the average last frost date, we might want to add a few more extra days just to be sure. But basically, there are some plants that we enjoy growing that are essentially tropical plants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, tomatillos, you know, these are all tropical plants. And so they really can't handle frost at all. So, you know, if you plant them out and then a week later there's a frost, they are not going to be happy. Mm-hmm. Same thing for cucumbers and squash. They really can't tolerate frost. So I'd look at your average last frost date for your region, add a few extra days for good measure, and then start planting those outside around that time. And for anyone who's doing seedlings indoors, you want to make sure that you do a transition between having your very coddled seedlings in an indoor environment and bringing them outside. If you, you know, switch them from indoors to outdoors on a very cold day, that can be a shock for them. If you put them out on a very hot day, it can be a huge shock. They can actually get sunburned. So anyone who's, even if you purchase seedlings or if you grow them yourself, in that week before you're going to plant them outside, you should actually bring them outside, inside, you know, just even a couple of hours at a time, or you know, put them in the shade where they're not going to have too much sun exposure, or a little bit sheltered from the wind. And much like how, you know, when we go out, you know, on a very sunny day in the spring, we might get sunburned if we haven't really been out in the sun for a few months. The same thing can happen to our plants. And so we have to really do that transition with them so that they get accustomed to the outdoors. But if your ground is unfrozen, but you still might have some frosts, some frosty temperatures, or some you know, very cold temperatures, some things that you can plant early on, even before your last frost date, are potatoes. You know, once your soil can really kind of be worked, and you know, you can get your hands into it, and you know, it's not too cold, there's not any ice, you can put the potatoes in. You can put in snow peas and snap peas, and even lettuce you can get in a little bit before the last frosts. But all of your cruciferous veggies, you know, if you're doing something like kale from seed outside, or collards, or bok choy or arugula, you can put those out before the last frost, even when it's still a little bit cooler. And spinach and radish, those also do well in slightly cooler temperatures. So there, you know, there are some things that we have to be very aware that the frost will kill them.
Yeah.
And then there's some other plants that are a bit tougher. So that's what we really need to distinguish between.
Okay. I'm wondering about ground cover. So I've seen in some farms there are certain plants that are also kind of growing around the plants you're growing for food. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, for sure. So that's a technique that's often used a bit more on farms than in gardens, but we certainly can use it in gardens too. Basically, it's growing plants that we're not necessarily intending to eat, but that in some way or another, they end up helping the soil, essentially.
Okay.
And so there's a concept in farming that's often used in veganics that's called green manures. And I know that sounds a little bit gross, green manure, but actually it's wonderful. It's basically growing plants that you feed back to your soil. So just to give an example, clover can be a really interesting one, because clover is actually a legume plant. So, you know, when we think of legumes, we often think of beans and peas, but clover is actually a legume plant. And legumes have this amazing thing they do, where they actually form a symbiotic relationship with some bacteria that can access nitrogen from the air. So there's like all of this nitrogen around us in the air that most plants just can't use. And they need nitrogen, they just can't use it in the chemical form that's in the air around us. But legumes, they have this cool relationship that they form with some bacteria that know how to access that nitrogen, and the bacteria share it with the plant, and the plant shares some sugars with the bacteria. So basically, if you grow something like clover, you could grow clover, for example, you could put it underneath your tomato plants once your tomato plants are well established, or you could grow clover in your pathways next to your garden, or you could grow clover in your front lawn and then use it as something that you could like fertilize your backyard with if you would like. You know, you can fertilize your garden with it. So basically, if you grow something like clover, you basically have like your own nitrogen producing factory at home, and you're just accessing this nitrogen that's right in the air, right around you. And then if you basically just cut that clover down, you know, with, you could do that with scissors, with a lawnmower, you know, you could work it in with a pitchfork if you want, whatever. But basically, if you take that clover and you feed it back to the soil in one way or another, by working it into the soil or adding it to your compost bin, or, you know, chopping it down and adding it as a mulch around your plants, that kind of any way you use it, it will end up feeding your other plants with nitrogen as it decomposes. So there's, you know, lots of different ways we can use cover crops or kind of, you know, or green manures, but that's one of them. And they can really serve these, you know, wonderful functions of basically being a source of fertilizer that you grow in your own backyard.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. And the thing is, you know, that's just the way it works out in nature. Like if you go around in nature and you see all sorts of clover here and there, that's its role. That's what it's doing. It's, you know, bringing nitrogen to all the other plants. And then in our kind of industrial agriculture system, we've created, you know, nitrogen factories that are super fossil fuel intensive because they take nitrogen from the air by using a lot of heat and a lot of pressure. So it uses tons of energy to do what legume plants do anyway. And, you know, and then if you think about cow manure, well, cow manure is often, you know, it's got nitrogen in it because the cows were fed legumes in a lot of cases. So the cow might have been fed, you know, clover, which is a legume, or alfalfa, that's a legume, or soybeans, which are a legume. And that's why its manure contains nitrogen. But if we just grow those legumes ourselves, you know, that's, we're just getting nitrogen straight from the source and then feeding it back to our gardens.
I love it. Oh my goodness. So cool. That leads me to another question. How can we kind of work harmoniously with the wildlife around us? I know an example here, lots of my neighbors and in town, people have these big gardens. We have a ton of deer. So what they'll do is they build like these walls around their garden, and it has like the wire and like wooden posts, and they have to be tall because the deer are so big, right? But it's essentially like this this house that's been made for the garden. It's the only way to keep the deer from eating. So how can we live harmoniously with our garden and our local wildlife?
For sure. And, you know, I would actually say that building a deer fence to some extent is living harmoniously to some degree, because, you know, if that's a way that someone's able to have their garden and it's not harming wildlife, then, you know, I'm quite happy with the idea that it is a harmonious way of interacting. I would just say in a situation like that, it's always nice to put some plants outside of that fenced off area so that the deer have something to eat too. I used to know people who had, you know, a fenced off area for their, you know, lettuce and cucumbers, but then they had some apple trees that the deer were welcome to eat from. And I mean, it sounds, when you're mentioning bear and deer, it sounds like you're very much in a forested area. So not everybody's going to be dealing with those challenges, but for other people, there might be squirrels, or there might be, you know, other critters. So I would definitely say to accept some losses. You know, in nature, most plants don't quite make it to maturity. And in our own gardens, you know, one thing we can do is just accept that our garden is, you know, both for us and for the animals, and that it's normal that animals eat things in the place where they live. Especially when we've taken almost all of their habitat and paved it over, you know, or we've, you know, clear cut it. And so, you know, if there's food around in the area they live, it's absolutely normal that they're going to munch on it, as we would too if we were hungry. So I encourage people to just develop that mindset that, you know, it's a wonderful thing to feed ourselves, and it's a wonderful thing to feed wildlife. Both of those are wonderful. So either way, we're accomplishing one of those goals. and we can grow more than we were initially intending to grow, in the sense that, again, in nature, you know, thousands of seeds would be sent out. Whereas in our garden, sometimes we plant, you know, 5 lettuce plants, and then we get a little bit, you know, possessive of them.
Right.
And, you know, whereas if we put down hundreds of seeds and we grew a bunch of mini lettuce plants, maybe we wouldn't be quite as bothered if some of them disappear. I also encourage people to grow a wide diversity of plants. You know, if you grow 5 different things and you lose one of them to a fungal disease and one of them to, you know, a woodchuck, it can feel a little bit disappointing. Whereas if, you know, I'll grow 30 different things in my garden, and I don't expect that they'll all have a great year. You know, one of them might do well, you know, even if there's a drought, and one of them might do well even if there's slugs, whereas another one might not. And that can be okay when we have diversity. And another thing we suggest is actually putting out water sources for animals, because oftentimes, especially in city environments, all of the natural water sources are gone. You know, all the streams have been, you know, put into like underground tunnels, and, you know, it's really, really tough, unless it's straight after a rain. It's really, really tough for, you know, insects and for critters to, you know, find water sources. And imagine if it was a really hot day and you couldn't find water, but you saw a cucumber, you'd be munching on that cucumber, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So by putting out, you know, bird baths, or it can even just be little bowls of water that are sitting around. It doesn't really have to be any more complicated than that. Sometimes we put little ponds into our gardens, which is, you know, essentially just a little mini pond with a few, you know, like bulrushes growing out of it, or some little water plants. And it doesn't have to be complicated. The only thing we suggest is making sure that animals could crawl out if they fall in. So making sure that, you know, it's, you don't put, you know, a really deep bucket that's buried, right, and, you know, with no way for an animal to crawl out. And even when we put, you know, bowls of water out for pollinators, they'll come and they'll just drink out of the bowl. And we might just put a couple of little pieces of wood floating on top, so that they've got like a little landing pad to go onto. But the other thing we can do is let some native plants grow. You know, sometimes birds, for example, might come and eat the cherries off of a cherry tree because we've cut down all of the other, you know, berry bushes that they like to eat from that don't serve any purpose for us. And so, you know, if we let some of those native plants grow, maybe the birds would have much preferred to eat something other than a cherry if it was available for them.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I'm imagining, as you were talking, I had such a vision of, like, because we also, in addition to the bears and the deer, we have like voles and chipmunks and mice and groundhogs. And every time we see one, we feel like so honored that they've chosen like our space to be here. And then the idea of like these little bowls with like little, like the bumblebees flying in to get a drink, and then a little mouse coming and getting a drink. And it was just a total beautiful fantasy that I just had, that you painted this picture for me. And I've been having such a good time with this interview, and now I'm like even feeling even happier. So thank you for that, weird as that might seem.
Well, that's wonderful. I mean, what I always say is, you know, we want to leave, you know, any piece of land that we start with, we want to make it more biodiverse than we found it. You know, and that biodiversity is plant biodiversity, and it's animal biodiversity too. You know, and one time we had a fox visit one of our gardens, and we were so excited. He just hung out for a day or two. But just the fact that the fox saw that as like an ecosystem that he wanted to hang out in, because we had so many climbing plants, there was a lot of shade. And, you know, whenever I have toads show up in the garden, I get so excited. I'm just like, wow, I created a place where they want to be. And sometimes, even in a community garden that I'm in, you know, I've had toads show up, and all the other gardens that are kind of bare soil and just like, you know, a couple of tomato plants here and there, the toads don't go there. But mm-hmm. if I have a pond and like a berry bush and a bunch of logs sitting around that they can hide under, that's where the toads visit.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I love it so much. So let's talk, Meg, about Learn Veganic.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So we started Learn Veganic 2 years ago to really offer, you know, guidance and support and mentorship and education to people who are interested in growing their own veganic gardens at home. So farmers can join us, but we're really focused on home scale gardeners. That's really where, you know, the main focus of what we teach is. And whether someone has, you know, a balcony or a patch in a community garden or a backyard or a little front yard that they're gardening in, we have an online course where we really go kind of step by step through how we can grow vegan gardens and like the diversity of ways we can grow veganic mm-hmm. gardens. Because, you know, I don't want to go into tons of depth about one technique if that doesn't apply to the place where someone's living, because we know everyone's got access to different types of land. And so there are so many ways we can garden veganically, and there are so many materials that we can use. And so what we try to offer is showing people that huge diversity of ways that we can garden veganically and showing people why different techniques would make sense in different contexts. So then at that point, people can kind of pick and choose which techniques they want to apply where they live. And as part of the course, we also have Q&A sessions where people can come and chat with us and chat with other veganic gardeners, just because oftentimes people don't have another veganic gardener in their neighborhood.
Right.
And so we bring together people from around the world who are really, you know, enthusiastic about starting gardens. And some people who join us are like, have never gardened before. This is going to be their first garden. Other people have been gardening for, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 years. And, you know, but what really brings everyone together is just this, you know, enthusiasm for growing their own food in a vegan way. Mm-hmm. And it's really wonderful. It's just wonderful to meet so many, you know, incredible people and to help them with their gardening projects.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That sounds amazing. You're right. Like I know a lot of vegans, but I don't know anyone who's doing veganic gardening.
Yeah.
Well, except for you. I know you now, but, but like locally, that is definitely not a thing. So I definitely see how I would have questions, and to have a community that I could tap into, it's like, that would be awesome. What a great service that you're offering.
Yeah, well, we love it too. I mean, you know, it's really my favorite time of the year when we, you know, teach veganic gardening and just meet people who are really, really enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, I love it. Well, the link, so you shared the link earlier, but for anyone who didn't write it down, don't worry, it'll be in the show notes. They can just click right into it and make their way over to your website and check out all the awesome things that you are working on. So Meg, I've got one final question for you.
Yeah, I think I know what it is.
You might. Tell us about your favorite hummus or favorite way to eat hummus.
So a few weeks ago, I actually sprouted fava beans for the first time. And I bought some fava beans from a sprouting company, and I thought, okay, this is cool. I can sprout them in a jar. And so it's just like, you know, you can sprout them in a day or two, but I let them sprout for about 4 or 5 days because I wanted a bunch of greens popping out of it. I wanted some, you know, chlorophyll and some extra nutrients. So basically, I took some fava beans, which are also called broad beans. I soaked them for about 8 hours, and then I just put them in a jar. I rinsed them a couple of times a day. And after a day or two, there was like this little root popping out. And then after 4 or 5 days, it had some leaves that were bright and green. And then I took that, I put it into a pressure cooker for a few minutes. And after that, I put it into a blender with some like veggie bouillon and, you know, a little bit of tahini. And I blended it all up and I tried it and I thought, wow, this is like hummus. I didn't know it was going to be so close. It like wasn't even, I knew I was trying to make some sort of bean dip, but you know, I didn't realize that it was going to be so close to you know, resembling hummus. And the thing about chickpeas is they're really hard to grow in the climates that many of us live in. They kind of require very hot temperatures, long seasons. And so there is that question, like, what else can we make hummus out of?
Yeah.
And something like black beans ends up being like a black bean dip. You know, it is quite different than hummus, but this fava bean thing, I was like, wow, this is actually pretty close. And I've grown fava beans in my garden before, and they also grow, you know, in, they're grown on a lot of farms up here in Canada. So I was just super, super excited to find my new kind of locally grown hummus alternative.
And sprouted too. Cool. Yeah. That is so cool. First of all, I did not know that about chickpeas. I'll admit, as much as I love them, I don't know anything about them. So I had no idea that they need a hot climate, that they need a long growing season. Never even thought to look into it.
Someone from Canada, because all I know is I can't grow them here. Okay. maybe a bit farther south is possible, but
okay. But I love that, and I'm going to give that a try. So just quickly before we go, I've never sprouted anything,
yeah.
And so you mentioned that you soak them and then you had them in a jar. So are they just wet in the jar, or is there water in the jar?
That's a great question. So the first few hours we're going to soak them just so that they kind of plump up and basically become alive. You know, we need to take this dormant seed and turn it into a living seed. So we're going to soak it for a few hours. And then after that, basically we put some sort of screen on, you know, I'll take a mason jar and I'll put some sort of screen on it. And for something that's big, like fava beans, you know, you can have a screen with relatively big holes. They're not going to fall out. So you can even take something like, you know, the type of bag that you would buy like onions in, or that would be on the top of like a clementine container where it's just kind of, you know, a piece of plastic with some holes in it. You can take something like that, put it on the mason jar with an elastic, and then you just want to invert it so that all of the water drains out. And then after that, you basically just rinse it twice a day. So in the morning and in the evening, it's basically, you want to keep it slightly damp, but not too wet. And you can even, yeah, if you have, you know, a piece of plastic with holes in it, a mason jar, an elastic, and a pot that you can turn it upside down in, that's all you need. And you just, if it ever goes moldy, put it in the compost. But as long as you're rinsing twice a day, it should be fine. And it's actually a lot easier to do during the winter, because it's something that it could get mold a bit more easily in very hot, humid weather in the summer. Okay. Whereas when it's a bit drier in the winter, a bit cooler, the risk of that happening is a lot lower. So it's actually one of the easiest gardening projects to start with, is just sprouting in a jar, because sprouting in a jar is like a 5-day project. So if you mess it up, you start again.
Yeah.
You know, you try it 2 or 3 times. And I would recommend sprouting in jars as one of the easiest gardening projects for people to try. And the cool thing is it's almost veganic by default, because you're not using any fertilizer, you're not using any soil. Yeah. So you don't even have to go through those questions about like, what type of special products do I need to get? You can just get some seeds and sprout them.
Huh. Thank you. I've learned much today, Meg. I am like super psyched about growing season, planting season, all of those things. And I am certain that my listeners will be too. Again, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been an amazing conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me here, Kimberly. It was wonderful chatting together.
Welcome back. What do you think? Are you itching to get some seedlings and start your own garden? One of my favorite things was how easy Meg made a compost pile seem. I had always felt intimidated by the process because it seemed like such a big undertaking. Here are 6 takeaways from this episode. Number 1, check for the typical last frost date in your area and add a few days onto that for good measure before planting seeds that are sensitive to cold. Number 2, if you've started with indoor seedlings, make sure to take the time to help your little plants acclimate to life outside. Bring them in and out and make sure they don't get sunburned. Number 3, leaves make for an excellent compost. Number 4, accept some losses. Not all plants will make it to maturity, whether due to fungus or local wildlife just finding them tasty. know that you won't get to harvest everything you've planted. Number 5, plant a wide diversity. It's great for our environment and for us. And number 6, if you leave water sources out for local wildlife, make sure that if an animal falls in, they can climb back out. To connect with Meg, visit her website, learnveganic.com, and get that free guide to 20 veganic materials Meg mentioned at learnveganic.com/materials. You can follow Meg on Facebook and Instagram at learnveganic. And of course, you'll find all of these links in the show notes. I hope you found this episode helpful and inspiring. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you're loving it, please give Did You Bring the Hummus a 5-star rating and leave a review. It's an easy way to keep supporting the show. Be sure to share these episodes with your friends. If you're finding something good here, they will too. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Did You Bring the Hummus, and visit my website, didyoubringthehummus.com, for more information about me, updates on what I'm working on, new podcast episodes, and all things vegan. Finally, I would love to hear from you. What do you need help with? Is there a topic you want to hear covered on a future episode? DM me on Instagram or send me an email at didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.